Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're really digging into one of science's great stories. It's a real detective story, actually, the discovery of DNA structure. And we're looking at it through a very specific lens, James Watson's own memoir, The Double Helix.
Exactly. And this deep dive uses a summary of that book, which gives us this, well, unfiltered insider view. You get the ambition, the rivalry, the sheer brain power, all the human stuff behind a massive biological breakthrough.
Yeah, that's our mission today, isn't it? To kind of peel back the official story, the neat textbook version. We want to see the messy human reality of how these huge scientific leaps actually happen.
It's fascinating because Watson really shows it's this complex mix. You've got intense personal ambition, fierce competition, moments of brilliant collaboration, and yeah, sometimes just pure luck playing a part. It's much more chaotic and honestly more interesting than you might think.
Okay, so let's start with the man himself, James Watson. He's our narrator, our protagonist. Who was he back then?
Well, he was young, really young, actually. An American zoologist, only 25 when they made the discovery in 1953. And his book gives this incredibly fresh, sort of unvarnished look at the science scene in Cambridge and London. But you have to remember, it is personal. It's his story, totally subjective, not like a dry history textbook. He's surprisingly candid about his own flaws and doesn't shy away from pointing out his colleagues' flaws either. It makes him very human.
So less of a formal report, more like a scientific memoir, you'd say.
Yeah.
What was he trying to achieve by writing it like that?
Precisely. He wanted to demystify the whole process, show the discovery isn't some straight line. He frames it like a detective story full of suspense, wrong turns, red herrings, and then this dramatic climax. It's definitely a warts and all kind of account. And I think he really wanted to make the science feel accessible, exciting, you know, show the journey, not just the end point.
Sounds great. So
yeah.
Where does his part of the story, his personal journey into this, really begin?
It probably kicks off in post-war Europe. Watson shows up, and he's feeling a bit uninspired by the research he'd been doing.
Okay.
But then he goes to this conference in Naples, and that's the spark. He sees this blurry image, an X-ray diffraction photo of DNA. It's from Maurice Wilkins, who's at King's College London. And for Watson, it's like a light bulb moment. He just knows the structure can be figured out.
Right. So that blurry photo is the catalyst.
Yeah.
And that leads him to Cambridge.
Yes. He makes his way to the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge.
Yeah.
Officially, he's there to study proteins.
But unofficially.
Unofficially, his mind is totally fixed on DNA. And there, he meets Francis Crick. Crick is, well, brilliant, very talkative, apparently. A physicist who'd switched to biology, a bit older, 35. And crucially, he's just as obsessed with DNA as Watson is.
Then they hit it off?
Instantly. It's his immediate bond. And their skills just clicked, you know? Watson had this biological intuition. Crick had the hardcore physics and theory background. Watson even wrote, "Francis was boundlessly curious about everything, and I enjoyed being with him." You could feel that connection.
Sounds like the perfect team. But I'm guessing it wasn't quite that easy. They didn't just solve it overnight. Oh, definitely not. Their first big attempt at building a model, total disaster. They threw together this three-stranded helix, kind of rushed it with a phosphate backbone stuck on the inside.
Yeah.
And Rosalind Franklin, who was doing the key experimental work at King's College, she took one look and basically told them it was chemically impossible, just wouldn't work.
Ouch. Public humiliation.
Pretty much. Big public humiliation. And it had consequences. Sir Lawrence Bragg, the head of their lab at Cavendish, was furious and actually forbade them from working on DNA anymore, told them to stick to their official projects.
Wow. So they're shut down.
Yeah.
And on top of that, wasn't there someone else famous in the running? A major competitor.
Absolutely. Looming over everything is the shadow of Linus Pauling, the giant of chemistry at Caltech. Pauling had this incredible track record for figuring out molecular structures. So Watson and Crick lived in constant fear, basically, that Pauling would beat them to it, announce a structure any day. That fear really cranked up the pressure, made it a real race.
This is where it gets complicated. And you mentioned Rosalind Franklin. While Watson and Crick are sidelined, what's going on at King's College? Because that becomes critical, doesn't it?
It really does. Over at King's, you have Maurice Wilkins and Rosalind Franklin. And their working relationship is, well, strained, to put it mildly. Watson's book definitely highlights the difficult gender dynamics in science back then.
And this leads to a really pivotal moment.
Yes. Wilkins, apparently quite frustrated with his own lack of progress and maybe the friction with Franklin, does something pretty controversial. He shows Watson one of Franklin's latest X-ray photos, her best one yet, the one we now know as Photo 51.
Photo 51, the famous one. What was Watson's reaction? What did that image tell him straight away?
He describes it so vividly. The instant I saw the picture, my mouth fell open and my pulse began to race.
Mm.
Because there it was, this distinct X pattern in the photo. For someone looking for a helix, that X is the telltale sign. It was, for Watson, definitive proof. Undeniable visual evidence they were on the right track with a helical structure.
Okay, that's a massive piece of the puzzle falling into place. But you said Wilkins showing him that photo was controversial. Why is that moment still debated so much?
Well, because Wilkins showed Watson Franklin's data, her photograph, apparently without her knowledge, certainly without her permission. And that act, that sharing of unpublished results, is probably the biggest ethical sticking point in the whole book. It gave Watson and Crick the confirmation and the crucial clue they needed, yes. But
it bypassed Franklin entirely.
Exactly. And it kicked off decades of debate about her actual contribution, about scientific credit, about how researchers, especially women researchers then, were treated. Watson, to his credit perhaps, includes it all very candidly.
So they see photo 51. They know it's a helix. How do they get from there to the final correct model? What were the last steps?
Right. So the momentum shifts back to them. And another key piece comes slightly unexpectedly. There's an American crystallographer, Jerry Donahue, visiting Cambridge, and he makes this seemingly casual correction. He points out that Watson and Crick are using the wrong chemical forms, the wrong tautomeric forms, for the DNA bases in their models. A small chemical detail, but absolutely vital.
Ah, one of those small details that changes everything.
Totally. And then, soon after that correction from Donahue, Watson has the final breakthrough, the real aha moment. He suddenly sees how the bases must pair up. Adenine A with thymine T and guanine G with cytosine C. Always A with T, G with C.
The specific pairing.
And that pairing suddenly made everything fit. It created this beautiful, symmetrical double helix structure. The excitement must have been incredible. Because the model wasn't just structurally sound, it instantly suggested how DNA could copy itself, how life itself could replicate. Watson basically felt a structure this beautiful just had to be right.
What a moment. It's an amazing story, blending the science with all this human drama. So if we step back now, what are the big themes? Beyond the molecule itself, what does Watson's telling of this story teach us about how discovery actually works?
Well, I think the first big takeaway, maybe the most obvious one from his book, is just how human science is. You know, forget the idea of scientists in white coats logically moving from A to B. Watson shows it's messy. It's driven by personal ambitions, rivalries, friendships, frustrations, egos, all of it. Science, he argues, seldom proceeds in the straightforward, logical manner imagined by outsiders. It really humanizes the whole endeavor.
It definitely challenges that idealized image. And
yeah.
What about competition versus collaboration? They seem like two big forces in the book.
Absolutely. That's maybe the second key theme. The whole story is framed as this intense race, right? Against Pauling, against the King's Group. And it shows how that fierce competition really can drive progress. It creates urgency, pushes people harder.
But at the same time,
you have the Watson and Crick partnership itself, which is just a textbook example of intellectual synergy. You had Watson's sort of biological intuition and visual thinking combined with Crick's rigorous theoretical brain power. The book makes it pretty clear neither of them could have cracked it alone. That collaboration was just as vital as the competition.
And we have to come back to Rosalind Franklin. Her role and how Watson portrays it is such a significant part of the book's legacy and the discussion around it.
Definitely. That's a third major theme, I'd say. The sort of unsung hero aspect and the ethical questions. Look, Watson's initial portrayal of Franklin was heavily criticized, rightly so. It reflected some pretty dated, frankly sexist attitudes of the time about women in science. But paradoxically, his candidness also makes it undeniable how crucial her work was. Her meticulous experiments, and especially photo 51, were absolutely essential to the breakthrough.
So the controversy highlights her importance in a way.
In a way, yes. And the fact that he openly describes, using her unpublished data that sparked and continues to spark, vital discussions about getting credit right, about acknowledging all contributions, and maybe about the sometimes ruthless nature of competitive science.
It wasn't just pure logic and data, though, was it? You mentioned luck earlier, and Watson talks about intuition, too.
Yeah, that's another important thread. Let's call it the role of intuition, aesthetics, and just plain luck. The discovery wasn't purely methodical deduction. There were these key moments of insight, flashes of intuition. There was also this strong sense of aesthetics, the feeling that the final double helix model was so elegant and simple, it just felt right. And yeah, luck played a part. Pauling making a crucial mistake in his own model, Watson happening to see photo 51 when he did, Jerry Donahue being there with that key chemical correction, serendipity was definitely in the mix.
Okay, so those are some big ideas about science itself. But what about for us listening today? We're not all trying to discover the structure of DNA. What are the practical, maybe modern lessons we can take from this 1950s story?
Well, first, I think it's about embracing the messiness of getting things done, of innovation. Watson's story screams that the path to any kind of breakthrough is almost never neat and tidy. It's full of mistakes, dead ends, backtracking, even humiliation sometimes. So for anyone trying to solve a problem in any field, maybe the lesson is see those failures and false starts not as the end, but as, you know, necessary steps, part of the process.
That's a good one. Resilient problem solving. What about teamwork, drawing from the Watson and Crick dynamic?
Right. The power of diverse collaboration. Their partnership worked because they were different. Different backgrounds, different skills, different ways of thinking. It suggests that if you want really innovative solutions, you need that kind of mix. You need different perspectives, maybe even a bit of constructive disagreement. A team where everyone thinks the same might not get you very far on the really tough problems.
And thinking about the Franklin situation, what's the lesson there about recognizing people's work?
It's a huge cautionary tale, isn't it? About bias, conscious or unconscious. It really underscores how important it is to be self-aware and to make a real active effort to see and credit everyone's contribution to a project. Regardless of their personality or their status or any other factor, it's not just about being fair, though it is that. It's also about building trust and a better working environment where everyone feels valued.
That makes sense. And one last one, you mentioned insights happening over lunch or during walks. What can we take from that?
Yeah, the importance of informal spaces for creativity. So many key conversations and ideas in the book didn't happen hunched over a lab bench. They happen at the pub, the Eagle, or just walking around Cambridge. It suggests there's real value in creating time and space for unstructured chat, for brainstorming without an agenda. Sometimes the best ideas pop up when you're not formally working.
Those are all really powerful takeaways. And the impact of what they found, it's hard to overstate, isn't it? They hinted at it themselves in the paper.
They did, with perhaps the most famous understatement in scientific literature. That final sentence in their Nature paper, "It has not escaped our notice that the specific pairing we have postulated immediately suggests a possible copying mechanism for the genetic material."
Just incredible. That one sentence basically unlocked the secret of heredity. How life passes on information. It launched molecular biology as we know it, changed everything. So here's a final thought for you, our listener, to mull over. Knowing this story, this very human, sometimes messy, competitive, ethically complex story behind the double helix, as told by Watson himself does, understanding that reality make the scientific achievement seem more impressive because it emerged from all that chaos. Or maybe less impressive because it wasn't purely objective brilliance. And maybe more importantly, what does this story suggest about the kind of environment we should try to create today in any field if we want to foster truly groundbreaking innovation? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the double helix and the fascinating human side of a world-changing discovery.
We hope you found it insightful. Maybe think about how some of these dynamics, competition, collaboration, dealing with setbacks, giving credit play out in your own world.
We look forward to our next deep dive into another fascinating topic.